From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, internal emails show delays and fumbles as the state DEQ tracked a plume of toxic chemicals around the Wolverine Worldwide site in West Michigan.
They were looking in kind of the wrong spot, and their geologist, their staff geologist in the DEQ, picked up on that pretty quickly.
Senator Gary Peters on what's missing from the newly unveiled White House plan on gun violence and school safety.
What we have to do is focus on things that the vast majority of the American people want. And one of those things is that we should have comprehensive background checks.
March Madness is here. The Wolverines head west. The Spartans head to Detroit for their opening game. And Tom Izzo's NCAA tournament streak continues.
21 years in a row, Izzo and I have joked about this. He said, man, I should just not make the tournament one of these years. To remind folks around here, it is not a birthright.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. And now the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Delayed public warnings about drinking water contamination and a cozy relationship with the alleged polluter. That's among new information that MLive is reporting about the way the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality handled the possible toxic contamination of groundwater in Belmont in West Michigan. The spotlight is on something known as the House Street Sludge Dump, where Wolverine Worldwide once dumped waste products from waterproofing shoes. That waste was full of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, chemical compounds called PFAS. MLive's Garrett Ellison is here with us now. Garrett, you have done a ton of reporting on the PFAS contamination by Wolverine Worldwide in the Grand Rapids area. Your piece in MLive that hit last night shows how you used a Freedom of Information Act request that yielded internal DEQ emails, and especially taking us back to last spring, say April of last year. What did you learn from those emails, Garrett?
Last April, the DEQ and Wolverine's consultant, Rosenwestra GZA, they were out in a neighborhood just on the northeast side of Wolverine's House Street dump, and they were canvassing, looking for homes where they could sample wells for PFAS contamination. They were looking in kind of the wrong spot, and their geologist, their staff geologist in the DEQ district office, picked up on that pretty quickly. He looked at the geology of the area and he identified homes to the south and the southeast of the dump, and he said, these homes really need to be looked at. And he had identified an old river channel that essentially flowed from the dump, which is on the high ground, to the Rogue River, and he said, the homes in this path are in the danger zone. That was on April 20th. None of those homes were tested until July at the earliest, September, October at the latest.
Which means people living there had no idea. And what was found when they were tested? What kind of contamination levels were there?
Well, when those homes were tested, the ones south of the dump, adjacent to the dump, and southeast along what's now become essentially the known plume path, really high levels of PFAS. What was considered to be the record, at least from state health and toxicologist perspective, was found immediately south of the dump, right next door. I think it's 49,000 parts per trillion total PFAS. That's more than just the PFOS and PFOA. That's all the different PFAS compounds they tested for. South of the dump site, there was a 10,000 parts per trillion hit. Next door to that was Seth McNaughton's home, where there was 5,000 parts per trillion. And Seth McNaughton and his wife, Tobin, they have a young son. He had just turned one at the time. He continued to drink these extremely high levels of PFAS from essentially April to September. His home had been identified in April as being in the danger zone, but nobody really got around to testing it until September. And that was only after attorneys in the area and, you know, myself as a reporter had been asking questions. Had this tannery PFAS thing had started to bubble up over the summer of 2017. That's really how these people found out.
And as you tell us in your story for MLive, this little fella, Jack, I'm going to use your language, his young blood is loaded with PFAS.
It's an incredible level. From what I understand, it's comparable to what you might expect to see in a chemical factory worker, somebody who's been exposed to this stuff for a long time. He's going to be 2 in April. You know, his parents are terrified what this means for his health as he grows up.
Also, what did you find through these emails with respect to how involved Wolverine was in helping the DEQ communicate with people about this problem?
Wolverine essentially made a deal with the DEQ and said, we'll cooperate as long as we get input on the communications. The DEQ, what they allowed Wolverine to do was draft public notices, submit them to the DEQ. Those public notices were then almost verbatim printed on DEQ, State of Michigan letterhead, and then submitted to folks in the area. So it was public communication drafted by Wolverine attorneys and then distributed by DEQ. No mention whatsoever of Wolverine, no mention of Scotchgard. They did mention PFAS, but in connection to Teflon and Gore-Tex, which are two products that do contain PFAS but have no connection to Wolverine whatsoever. So DEQ showed a lot of deference to Wolverine in terms of letting the company draft and dictate its own public communications.
As you so skillfully put in your piece, the DEQ moved with spurts of urgency forced by happenstance while they were showing this notable deference to Wolverine's desire to keep the matter quiet. And you also report a DEQ official admitted to sharing an MLive FOIA request with Wolverine's attorney the day before giving you the requested information. Did you ask him why they did this?
Yeah, I discovered this the day that I got my request. It was in August. I had submitted a FOIA request for a status update on the Wolverine's tannery site itself. This was before I even knew about the House Street dump site. When I got a copy of my request, the DEQ gave me access to the FTP server to see, okay, so here's your information, go ahead and download it. There was a folder marked Ellison, and then there was a folder marked John Bile. And John Bile is Wolverine's attorney. So I clicked on that folder, and it was my FOIA request. And so I called John Bile, and I said, how did you get my FOIA request, and how did you even know that I requested information? Well, I talked to David O'Donnell at DEQ. Oh, okay. And so I called David O'Donnell and said, how would John Bile know to ask for my FOIA request? Why are you telling him that I requested information about the tannery? And his response was surprisingly candid. He said, you know, that's not the way it should have been done. I'm sorry. It stinks in kind of an ethical way, and I let relationships get in the way of thinking. And he kind of explained that the way that the DEQ handles media FOIA requests is there's a bit of an extended process than normal citizens or corporations like Wolverine need to go through. Essentially, he told John Bile about my request. John Bile said, well, why don't you give me all of that information that MLive FOIA'd as well in part of a Wolverine FOIA request that was ongoing.
David O'Donnell is a DEQ supervisor who, as you point out in your piece, has been promoted since all of this, and he's kind of a central player to this response. What is the big takeaway for the public here, Garrett?
Well, I talked to James Clift at the Michigan Environmental Council. He reviewed some of these emails at my request. He came away with seeing a reflection of an under-resourced DEQ showing deference to a polluter with money, willing to step up to the table and say, okay, we'll take care of this, but we're going to pay for it under a voluntary program in the state's toxic cleanup law. And because we're willing to pay for it and you guys are running on fumes for paying for toxic cleanups, we are going to do it under these conditions. We want to be able to control communications. You know, the takeaway here, I think, is because this company was allowed to sort of drive the bus, an investigation into its own pollution, the DEQ wasn't able to say, well, we're just going to do this ourselves and then conduct cost recovery later. Had they decided to take maybe a stronger hand, perhaps some of the exposure that occurred could have been stopped earlier.
Garrett Ellison's piece is at MLive.com. Garrett Ellison, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Time for Am I Curious, where you ask the question and we dig up the answer.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Recently, we answered your questions about our roads as I talked with the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, Kirk Steidel. Well, turns out you had a lot of questions. So let's continue talking roads with MDOT. And here's today's question.
Hi, this is Ryan True from Rochester Hills. Why does the state of Michigan, especially Metro Detroit, use so much rock salt? Would it be feasible to use sand or a sand-salt mix?
Kirk, what do you think?
Well, we use a sand salt mix, but we use it in areas where we have ditches and not where we have enclosed sewers. Because just all you have to think about is you put sand on the road and it's in an enclosed sewer and then it goes down the drain. It does not flush all the way out. What it does is plugs up your drains. So then you've got to spend maintenance efforts to go in and clean out the drain so you actually have a full drainage system as well. So we do use sand and salt, but in areas where there aren't enclosed sewer systems. The amount of salt that we've used also has dropped significantly over my career. We used to really, really pour on salt, and there's been a lot more research and practices put in place that have reduced that amount, even so much as they do a scatter test. They did a test for how the salt comes out of the back of the truck to make sure it doesn't bounce off the road and doesn't do any good in the ditch. So they've done lots of research on that piece. So we can, and we have, reduced the amount of salt, which is, frankly, the environmental impact and to all of our cars as well. And they try new additives, and they put new treatments down on the road ahead of time to try to stay ahead of it. But at the end of the day, that is the most cost-effective material out there is de-icing salts. There are some other chemicals, but they cost significantly more. And we use those, say, on the Zewaukee Bridge and a couple of other structures that we really do not want that damage from the salt. We cannot afford that salt to get into some of those tendons on that.
Well, Kirk, to your point about the environmental concerns, certainly people worrying about salt ending up in our freshwater ecosystems, and we certainly know what salt does to roads and automobiles. And there are other states experimenting with some interesting alternatives. New Jersey, North Dakota, and others are using a mixture that includes beet juice. New Hampshire and Maine use one with molasses, according to the Detroit News. Is MDOT exploring other alternatives? Could there be a better way?
Yeah, there are. In fact, we used beet juice probably 10 or 12 years ago, and it works. What we also got was a significant amount of complaints about the smell. People would bring it back to their house, and it would be on their car, and they'd drop in it. Really, really smelled. So we've experimented with those as we work with researchers that come up with a new one. We experiment with those at the same time. So if there's a better mousetrap out there, we'd love to have it and love to use it. If somebody knows of one, please send it along.
That's Kirk Steidel, director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. And if you've got that better idea, we've got a link to MDOT's contact page on our website, michiganradio.org. Up next, sports commentator John Eubanks on Selection Sunday and March Madness.
For all the drum beating from the NCAA, how computerized we're going to be, how high tech and so on, nope, it's records. Michigan State's is flatly better.
We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. March Madness is officially upon us now that the NCAA has announced its 68-team field and let those who love college hoops plunge into drawing up their brackets. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubanks is here now with his thoughts. So, Michigan State is a number 3 seed against Bucknell playing Friday at Little Caesars Arena in Detroit. And you called it. They wanted that.
They definitely wanted that. Izzo was asking for this basically the last 2 weeks, and he got it, which tells you that the NCAA selection committee did in fact like Michigan State more than Michigan. Not necessarily surprising, but the NCAA selection committee kept on talking for weeks, a whole season really, that this year we're going to pick them differently, and not just the records, which is the normal way, and the rankings, but all this computerized stuff, strength of schedule, quadrant one victories, quadrant two victories, quadrant three victories, all this
kind of mind-melting.
mumbo-jumbo if you're not deep into it, as my job requires. And the mumbo-jumbo would favor Michigan. The computers would favor Michigan. They've beaten Michigan State twice. They've played the top three teams in the Big Ten 7 times, which is Purdue, Ohio State, and Michigan State. Michigan State has gotten off easily. Strength of schedule, they're 13 out of 14 in the Big Ten. And turns out, so what? For all the drum beating from the NCAA, how computerized we're going to be, how high tech and so on, nope, it's records. Michigan State's is flatly better. They're 29-4. Michigan is 28-7. And Michigan State won the regular season title, which is harder to win than the Big Ten tournament title.
Okay.
It's 4 games versus 18 games, not even close. So they went old school in this thing. Michigan State is your winner. But Michigan got a very good draw. They're in the West, which is not where you want to be. It's far from home. But I think their bracket is easier than Michigan State's.
So that's what I wanted to know. Who got the better deal, do you think? Because first of all, let's just recap where Michigan, with third seed in the West, so they're going to play number 14 Montana Thursday. And we see Michigan State playing Bucknell on Friday. And then onward from that, who got the better deal?
Michigan did. I would say short run, Michigan State did. Playing in Detroit is obviously your backyard. Mm-hmm. That's where the Spartan alums often live, of course. So I cannot imagine a scenario where they lose in Detroit the first two games against weak competition. Okay. But I know you're warning.
I know. I'm remembering 2 years ago, State lost 90-81 to Middle Tennessee. It was the biggest upset Tom Izzo ever suffered.
It's one of the biggest upsets in the history of the tournament. Plays about as well as Appalachian State in football for Michigan because Middle Tennessee State is not actually a state. It's a region. So there's your problems.
And no one saw that coming. So
no one did. It's one of the biggest shockers, frankly, in the history of the tournament. So every night in this tournament, you're on a high wire. Every single night. And every night, one of those two teams goes home, no safety net, packs your bags, you're done. So trust me, the first weekend, there'll be five or six at least big shockers. I sincerely doubt it'd be Michigan State or Michigan this time around. So Michigan's got a tougher situation the first weekend. After that, they've got an easier bracket. Michigan State's got to go through Auburn, fourth, Duke, second, Kansas, first seed. Michigan's got Gonzaga, UNC, and Xavier. Xavier ain't Kansas, man. So ultimately, it's going to be a tougher road for Michigan State than it is for Michigan. So short run, Michigan State benefits. Long term, Michigan benefits.
And yet there are analysts on ESPN picking Michigan State to go all the way.
With good reason. They've got all the pieces. They're playing good basketball. They've got all the pieces. They've got the best front court, Thomas said, in the history of his coaching career at Michigan State. That is saying a heck of a lot because seven of his teams have already been to the Final Four. So that's a very good pick. I would say some folks are picking Michigan as well. Michigan can beat anyone on a given night. The catch is they can also lose to anyone, as they almost did to Iowa, an unimpressive Iowa team, in overtime in the first game of the Big Ten tournament. So they can beat or lose to anybody, so the crapshoot is on.
The crapshoot is on. When you think that this is the eighth tournament appearance for John Beilein with his Wolverines and the 21st straight for Izzo and his Spartans, so,
Harder than it looks.
Harder than it looks. Yeah, don't just look at that and go, well, of course they make it.
Couple things. One, Steve Martin, the old comedian, of course, I read his book. It's quite smart. And he said, the hard thing in stand-up comedy is not to be great on a given night, because at a certain level, anybody can be. The hard thing is to be good every night, no matter what. You got a cold, the crowd is not into it, it's second show on Friday, make it happen anyway. And 21 years of this, the hard thing is when your team is not focused, when you don't like some of your players, when the breaks are not going your way, get there anyway. And 21 years in a row, Izzo and I have joked about this. He said, man, I should just not make the tournament one of these years. To remind folks around here, it is not a birthright. It is not. And Beilein's done a great job, but 8 is not 21. And that's how hard it is.
Any surprises for you from Selection Sunday, particularly any Big Ten team that you thought should have been included?
Big Ten has 4 teams out of 14 in the tournament this year. It's the least they've had in 10 years. They almost always get 7 teams. Mm-hmm. Half the league gets in on a given year. So this is definitely a slight to the Big Ten. Part of it, though, is just the way the season played out. You had 4 big boys, and it fell off dramatically since then. You only had 5 teams above 500, which is not where you want to be out of 14. So you really had haves and have-nots. The top 4 teams, Michigan State, Ohio State, Purdue, Michigan, are great big-time teams, all third seed or higher. And after that, it falls off dramatically. So not a great year for the Big Ten, but any one of those 4 teams could get to the Final Four, and you can rarely say that.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John U. Bacon. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Growing your own business means persisting past uncertainty and rejection, having a clear idea of what your product's about and where you want to take your business. Detroiter Melissa Butler is proof of that. Melissa Butler is the founder and CEO of The Lip Bar. It's a non-toxic, cruelty-free, and vegan line of lipsticks and lip glosses. And her desire to offer something new in the beauty industry It grew from an idea into something that has been picked up by Target. Melissa Butler, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
Melissa, what got you to change lanes? You had a career in finance. And what led you to say, you know what, I want to launch a lipstick line?
So, yeah, I was young and living in New York City, working on Wall Street. And ultimately, I decided to start the lip bar because I noticed some really troubling things within the beauty industry. So, first of all, I tried to take a more holistic approach to my lifestyle. I'm like, okay, I have a little bit of money. I can live my best life, essentially. So I started actually reading all of the ingredients on the backs of, like, the foods that I was eating, the hair products I was using, and ultimately the makeup and the cosmetics that I was buying. So I decided to take a more holistic approach and say, like, you know what? I'm going to adapt, like, more of a whole foods lifestyle, and I am going to actually have, like, natural hair care and natural skin care. And when it came to the makeup industry, it was very challenging to actually find makeup that not only looked good on my complexion, but also makeup that wasn't filled with unnecessary toxins and chemicals. So I searched high and low, and what I found was if makeup was a little bit more natural or had any sort of stance like vegan or cruelty free, it was boring colors. So I literally started making lipstick in my kitchen for my own personal use and then quickly discovered that there was an entire market who felt the exact same way as I did.
Was this about wanting more women to feel included at the beauty table, if you will?
Oh, absolutely. So when I thought about beauty, it was very linear. And even to this day, like, the media and the makeup, the other beauty companies, they tell a very linear story of what beauty is. And the reality is, you know, most people don't look like models. And we shouldn't be forced or feel that pressure that this is the only thing that beauty is, because we believe that beauty looks like you and me and my mom and my sister and you know, and there's beauty in everyone. But if you don't have that representation telling this more inclusive story on what beauty is, then you kind of feel left out. And so, like, for instance, at that time when I started formulating the lipstick, lipstick really only came in, like, reds, pinks, and nudes. And it's like, okay, well, what if I want to express myself? What if I want to wear purple lipstick? Or what if I want to wear, you know, something as bold as, like, black lipstick? I have to search high and low for it. And at the time, we had customers telling us, like, when we first launched, we launched with a bunch of crazy colors. And people would say, like, oh, you know, I've worn this color before, but I used to mix it with eyeshadow and Vaseline to achieve this color.
So from that, at your kitchen table, mixing formulations and coming what the kind of colors you wanted and doing it in a way that is non-toxic and cruelty-free and vegan. So that was the idea. How did your business model evolve, Melissa?
When we first launched, I was making the lipstick in my kitchen. So everything was really small, small batches, handcrafted, like sourcing really awesome organic oils and really just made with love and care. And it was great, but that's not sustainable. So when I found out that we actually had a business, I was like, okay, well, how can we scale this? So I ended up finding a contract manufacturer in California. So now the small batch thing is gone. And that kind of hurt me because I was so close with the product. But, you know, our ingredients stayed the same. But the one thing that evolved that stood out the most is, you know, when I launched the lip bar, our motto was challenging the beauty standard. And it's still our motto to this day. It's still why I wake up and work hard. But one day I said, am I really challenging the beauty standard if my lipstick comes in at a $20 price point? Because our lipsticks used to be $20. And I'm like, well, now, you know, now that it's not made by hand, that gives me a little bit more flexibility with the price. And I can really create this beauty that's responsibly made, but also accessible and affordable. So we dropped our price point like 30-40%. So our lipsticks literally went from $20 to $12. And I think that was like the biggest change in the business model. And it just reinforced why we do what we do. And it's really to challenge that beauty standard, because like everything we do is like our beliefs. So it's like, we believe that beauty shouldn't compromise your health. We believe that it should be affordable and accessible, but also we believe that beauty isn't linear. So like our imagery is diverse, our storytelling is diverse, And everything that we do is just to, like, try to empower women to be their best selves.
And did you turn to investors to help launch and grow the lip bar?
Not to launch it. So I launched it with my own money from working on Wall Street. But then we decided that we needed to grow. And so we went on a show. We didn't get a deal. And it's a very popular show. And they were really cruel to us when we went on to the show.
I know you're talking about Shark Tank. And we know that they can be kind of vicious to people. So how did that experience of being rejected by the sharks, how did that affect you?
Honestly, a lot of people ask me, like, well, how did you keep going after Shark Tank? And I had never really considered the fact that, you know, taking such public defeat or rejection was such a big deal. For me, it was just like, I know that these people weren't my audience. So it hurt at first, but then ultimately it just made me want to have a laser-like focus on my industry, on people who got it. Because, like, that night, we got that positive affirmation when the show aired. We got, like, 30,000 hits to our website that night. Over the next 2 weeks, like, an additional 120,000, 130,000 people. And thousands of emails of people just saying, like, oh, my God, I'm so happy I saw you on Shark Tank. I've been looking for something like this. Or, you know, they didn't know what they were talking about, but now I'm so happy that I found you. I just made a purchase. So when we were on the show, we pitched the idea of our lip bar truck. And they laughed at us. They told us it was a horrible idea. And we built it anyway. Because ultimately, like, I decided that they didn't have the right to decide on my fate and my dreams and my business. So, like, I tried to find some constructive criticism and decided to just keep moving and moving forward towards my goal because I really believed in what we were doing and that challenging the beauty standard. So we went ahead, we built the lip bar truck, and it ended up being, like, our most innovative marketing tactic. So I'll never forget, I was on the New Jersey Turnpike and we're at the toll booth and a lady is looking at the truck and the truck is beautiful. Like, it's lips all on the outside. It's like a bar and mirrors and lights and you can actually try on the product. It's essentially a beauty store on the wheels. And so we're at the New Jersey Turnpike at the toll booth and the young lady is looking at the truck. She's looking at me. She's going back and forth and she's like, wait a minute. I saw you on Shark Tank and I bought your lipstick. She pulls out a lipstick out of her purse. And, like, that was, like, the defining moment. Like, I knew what we were doing was right.
And it was
going to
work.
And so, yeah, I think that's, like, the big thing. Like, you can't allow other people to get in the way of your dreams. Like, you're always going to hear no. You're always going to fail. But it's really, like, what you do after that failure that's going to be, like, your defining moment.
And, Melissa, you decided to move out of New York City and bring your business back to your hometown of Detroit. Why was that?
I felt like New York didn't need me. I felt like I could do a lot more in my city. My ultimate goal is to build a manufacturing facility at home. And it's been something that we've had to, like, put on pause for a second as we've been growing. Right now we're making everything in California, but we're working towards building that facility here.
And now Target has picked up the lip bar product. So what does that mean for you in terms of having to ramp up production and growth for your business?
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Like, we launched in 42 stores just mid-February, and the first 2 weeks we sold out of everything. And so Target is like, now, whoa, like, you have, like, a real business on your hands. So we're already talking about, you know, what that looks like for the future, but also, you know, placing those reorders. So we've had to ramp up our production quite a bit, reaching out to my manufacturers, just letting them know the good news, but also that now there's pressure. We need to start producing a little quickly.
And I know you've got the standalone store in Detroit in Indian Village. Do you want to do more standalone stores? And you also are selling online, but do more standalone stores fit in your plan?
Not at the moment. I really just wanted to do something at home because it's really important for me to have a footprint in Detroit. You know, I feel like this city has given me so much, so I wanted to, like, do my part in building the entrepreneurial footprint and that startup footprint. So I don't really have more stores, like standalone stores for the lip bar, but of course more distribution in, like, the form of Ulta, Target, etc.
What could other would-be entrepreneurs learn from your story, Melissa?
Perseverance and really just having a strong why. So when I think about not giving up, it was really just because I really believed in what I was doing. And I knew, I prepared myself in knowing that things are not going to be easy. So if you have an idea, if you believe in it through and through, there's nothing that's going to stop you. So if you want to get into business, I would just recommend that you really do a ton of research, that you figure out how you fill that white space. Like, why does your product need to exist? And when you believe in that fully, there's nothing that can stop you.
Melissa Butler, the founder and CEO of The Lip Bar, a non-toxic, cruelty-free, and vegan line of lipsticks and lip glosses. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us on Stateside, Melissa.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Still to come, we'll hear Senator Gary Peters' take on various issues, including legislation that would loosen bank restrictions put in place after the financial crisis.
You've got to have a vibrant banking sector with lots of competition. That's the best thing for consumers. Is if you have banks competing for your business, you're going to do a whole lot better than if we end up with just a handful of banks in this country. I think that would be horrible.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gun safety, new banking regulations, unaccounted for government spending. There is never a shortage of issues being debated and discussed on Capitol Hill. With us now to talk about a few of them is Senator Gary Peters. Senator Peters, welcome back to Stateside.
That's great to be with you.
Let's start with this morning's news. The Trump administration is rolling out its plan to respond to violence and guns in our schools. It wants to provide firearms training to some teachers, so arming teachers, but backs off making major changes to gun laws. So there's nothing about raising the minimum age to buy guns from 18 to 21. And following the mass shooting at Parkland in Florida, the president said he was in favor of raising the minimum age, and that apparently was backed off after he met with the NRA. What do you make of the president's efforts so far responding to school shootings?
Well, I think his response to school shootings is the same response he gives to everything, which means he'll make one statement. A day later, it'll be something different. The third day will be something completely different from the other two. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, any kind of consistency. And whenever he says something, you've got to figure whoever talks to him last will likely have an impact.
And he has set up this Federal Commission on School Safety chaired by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Do you have confidence in Secretary DeVos and this committee?
I don't know one way or the other. I don't have a whole lot of confidence, though. I certainly would like to hope that there would be some thoughtful ideas and comprehensive ideas and not based on politics or the agenda of the NRA. But it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. I think what we have to do is focus on things that the vast majority of the American people want. And one of those things is that we should have comprehensive background checks. It is something that everybody in this country seems to agree on, that before you purchase a weapon, you should go through a background check. Currently, because of the loopholes with gun shows and buying online, 40% of all guns are sold without any kind of background check. 40%. That makes no sense whatsoever. And when you look at the gun violence every single day, and this is the other thing that I think it's very important to remember, and as tragic as the incident was in Florida and 17 lives were lost, we have to remember that every single day, roughly 90 people die of gun violence. Every single day. Every month, 50 women die of domestic violence with a weapon. These are huge numbers, and it's happening every single day. And one thing we know that can be effective in reducing those numbers is making sure we have comprehensive background checks. We first have to make sure the system works, and hopefully we can get a what they call a fix the NIC, which is the system that puts in the data. But you can't just do that. You've also got to make sure it actually applies to every weapons purchase. And so that's what I'm pushing for and my colleagues are pushing for. That will make a meaningful step forward. And you know, even if you ask rank-and-file NRA members, I think it's something like 65-70% believe we should do that. 90% of the American people think we should have comprehensive background checks. There are very few issues in this country where 90% of the American people agree.
And yet,
you know, a tragedy happens and people turn to Congress and ask the question, what is it going to take to get Congress to actually act and do more than sending thoughts and prayers every time there's a mass shooting?
Well, we have to get the leadership to put it on the table to vote on. And so the Republicans control the House, the Republicans control the Senate, and we have a Republican in the presidency. All we're saying, let's put it on the floor, let's vote. Let's take an up or down vote on comprehensive background checks, and then those folks have to go back to their districts or their states. We've got elections coming up in 2018. They're going to have to defend what they do one way or the other.
Let's move to net neutrality. The FCC has published the final notice of its repeal of net neutrality rules, so the countdown is on to actually repealing it. We're in the final weeks of unrestricted internet. What do you believe lies ahead for Michigan consumers and businesses once net neutrality is gone?
Well, I'm very, very concerned that you are going to have basically two classes of the internet. The folks who can pay to have much higher speeds, large companies, will be able to dominate a lot of aspects of the internet because they'll have the faster highway to the rest of us. That has an impact on individual users. It certainly has a big impact on small businesses as well. You know, part of the beauty of the internet was its equalizing factor is that when you got on the highway of the internet, you all had the same speed. And speed is pretty important in the internet. You know, having access to high speed allows you to connect for the e-commerce. It allows you to access new technologies in telemedicine, which will bring healthcare to people in rural areas. But you need to have net neutrality to make sure everybody has equal access.
And you've joined with other Democrats and at least one Republican in a bill to reverse the FCC ruling using something called the Congressional Review Act, the CRA. What is that?
Well, it allows you to repeal basically an act that goes forward, and then you need a majority vote. So you need 51 votes. We are one vote short in the Senate to do that. So we're putting, having folks call their U.S. senators. No worries here in Michigan. Both of us are on there, but in other states, we're just one vote away.
You've recently unveiled a bipartisan bill to help small farmers. Tell us about what this bill would do.
Well, this is a bill to increase the FSA funding, which is federal funding through the Department of Ag, to help small farmers with loans. They're guaranteed loans that then go through the local banks, similar to SBA loans for small businesses. They're absolutely critical if you're a small farmer. In fact, I was at a small farm just Friday, Dreamwinds Farm over on the west side of the state. A young farmer who always dreamed of being a farmer now is in business. He started with 30 cows. He now has 250 cows, a great family business that he and his wife run. It would not have happened without these loans, but they're capped currently. And so there's a limited amount. And then when they hit the cap, they stop. And in fact, Paul, who is the owner, talked about how he needs to take out a loan for feed or something to move his operations forward, and then you can't do it, and then you're really in a pickle. So my legislation extends the cap by 25%, or it gives the flexibility. You don't have to increase the cap. It depends on the demand, but it provides additional loans for those smaller farms. And I think it goes to the very heart of what is important to not only Michigan, but to the country, and that's to have family farms. You know, we've got more and more of these corporate farms. It's very difficult to be a family farmer, and yet it's a good living if you have the resources and the capital to start. And it's about who we are as America. Yeah, you know, it harkens back to the days of Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the Republic would be safe as long as we had yeoman farmers who owned their piece of America and were independent and were voting. And today we'd call that the American middle class.
And what are the political challenges to getting this bill passed?
Well, it's bipartisan. So I'm working with Dave Perdue, Republican out of Georgia. We hope to move it forward. We have the support of most all of the major farming organizations have also endorsed it. So we're hoping it may be part of the farm bill that will eventually move if it can't move on its own. The farm bill has traditionally been a pretty bipartisan piece of legislation, and we hope that it continues to be so.
If you just joined us, we are talking with U.S. Senator Gary Peters, just kind of picking his brain on a variety of issues. Last week, the Senate voted to begin debate on a banking bill that would bring about the first big overhaul of banking regulations since Dodd-Frank was passed in 2010 in response to the financial meltdown. So it would roll back and revise regulations on banks, including raising the threshold set by Dodd-Frank that would trigger stricter oversights by the Federal Reserve. It was $50 billion in assets. The bill raises that to $250 billion in assets. So it would exempt some 20 financial companies. You and Senator Debbie Stabenow were among the 16 Democratic senators who joined
with Republicans to advance this bill. Why?
Well, it's basically about smaller banks, too. It's not just raising the threshold. That's one aspect of it. But it's about taking some of the regulations that were added under Dodd-Frank that impact credit unions. The credit unions, for example, are very strong supporters of this legislation. Community banks are small. Small banks in our communities are very supportive. And, you know, I served on the Dodd-Frank Conference Committee. Not only did I support Dodd-Frank, I was on the committee that negotiated the final version. I was placed on there as a freshman, which is very unusual to have a freshman on the conference committee. So I believe very strongly in Dodd-Frank. But it's also, it was a very large piece of legislation that you need to go back and tweak, and particularly when it came to smaller institutions, as well as regional banks, which are the ones that you mentioned. You know, what had happened and what I was very concerned about as we went into the financial crisis is that we had seen increased concentration of money in a very few very large banks, and smaller banks were having a harder time to compete. But what has happened since that time and since Dodd-Frank, we've actually had even further concentration. We have bigger and bigger banks that are dominating the marketplace. I do not think that that is healthy. You've got to have a vibrant banking sector with lots of competition. That's the best thing for consumers. Is if you have banks competing for your business, you're going to do a whole lot better than if we end up with just a handful of banks in this country. I think that would be horrible. And so part of that is this legislation is to make sure smaller community banks, credit unions, and regional banks have the flexibility they need to be profitable. And we should always remember that the financial crisis was not caused by your local credit union. It was not caused by a community bank or a regional bank. It was the large Wall Street banks.
Critics say, though, that this bill will still help big banks.
Well, it's simply not accurate. I mean, this is really about regional banks and those below. You know, even Barney Frank, although he said he wouldn't vote for this for obvious reasons because he was the drafter of it, but he also said this is really a pretty small tweak to the act. And he said, actually, that by passing this is like the rework. It actually enshrines the vast majority of Dodd-Frank is now enshrined in law after this bipartisan bill. So I think, you know, that's the way you've got to look at it, is that we've got to be practical. And quite frankly, you know, if you're a large Wall Street bank, you want strict regulations on yourself and everybody else, because you know that you can now hire all the people to handle all of that regulation. But if you're a small bank, it is incredibly expensive. And that's why, quite frankly, a lot of community banks here in Michigan, 20% of community banks have gone out of business since the financial crisis. And they have a very large regulatory burden, which raises their cost disproportionate to those of the very large banks that can absorb it. So if you have a candid conversation with Wall Street Bank, they'll tell you they like regulations because it gives them a competitive advantage. And we can't give them a competitive advantage, so we only have five large banks in this country. That would be really bad.
The bill certainly seems to have exposed a rift in your party, with a lot of Democrats asking, have you forgotten what the banks did to cause the crash that hurt Michigan so deeply? Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown said you and others who support the rollback are suffering from collective amnesia. What do you say to them?
I will say, and of course I have the highest respect for Sherrod, he is a wonderful senator and a colleague of mine, is that I don't have amnesia. I remember very vividly that credit unions did not cause the crisis. I remember very vividly that small community banks didn't cause the crisis, or regional banks. It was really large Wall Street banks that was engaged in very speculative derivatives activities. You know, it was derivatives that leveraged what was a risky situation, but by many, many times. When it comes to derivatives regulation, that's still part of Dodd-Frank. Those are enshrined, and that will not be changed by this legislation.
Currently underway is the first ever full audit of the Pentagon, and so far it's not going very well. In February, Politico reported the accounting firm Ernst & Young found the Defense Logistics Agency failed to properly document more than $800 million in construction projects alone. As a member of the Armed Services Committee and the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Federal Spending Oversight, what are your thoughts on how that Defense Department audit's going so far?
Not well. It's not going well at all. It's really proving what I have always been concerned about and have asked that we need to have a full and complete audit of the Department of Defense, which is starting to go through. It's not complete. But just the Defense Logistics Agency, which I think you're referencing there, is very concerning that you have an organization spending hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars over a period of time, and you can't fully account for it. It's simply unacceptable. So we're going to be continuing to push that. As you mentioned, I'm the ranking member on the federal spending oversight. So we look at a wide range of federal spending, but we've got to really focus on the Department of Defense. It's a large budget item. National defense is important. We want to make sure that they get the funding that they need. But they have to be accountable to the taxpayers that you're actually spending it wisely. And, you know, one area that I'm particularly concerned about with that is just the procurement system, is when we procure weapon systems that are vitally important, and we're going to have a whole slew of new ones coming on board, but they always seem to have cost overruns and then more cost overruns. We've got to stop that. That's simply unacceptable.
Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said keeping track of the people's money may not be in the Pentagon's DNA. How do you feel?
Well, we got to change that.
What would you do to tighten oversight of Pentagon spending? How should it be changed?
Well, first off, is this audit process. You know, this didn't happen before. I'm just at a loss for words as to why we haven't been doing this all along. You know, any business does audits. I know when I was running my offices in the private sector, you always prepared for audits. And when you got your audit reports, you had to fix those audit problems. And if you did really well, you got a bonus. So you had an incentive to make sure you could actually account for every single penny. And certainly the company demanded that. And we should demand nothing less of the Department of Defense as taxpayers. And certainly we need to do that all across all levels of government and in every single agency. But the Department of Defense has a notorious history of not keeping track the way they should.
I want to talk about reaction to the head-spinning daily flood of headlines that pour out of the White House. Payoff money to an adult film actress, serious questions about Jared Kushner and the president's sons mixing personal business with government business, the president's refusal to impose the sanctions that Congress voted to slap on Russia for meddling with our election. I'm going to stop there. There's so much more. And yet, silence from Mitch McConnell, from Paul Ryan, from most every Republican except perhaps Jeff Flake. When you talk with your Republican colleagues, you're away from the cameras, you're away from the microphones, what do you hear from them? How are they responding to this?
Well, I don't think they're pleased with it, and they certainly are very tired of trying to constantly explain it away because there really is no good explanation for it. But it still frustrates me that if they say that in private, I don't know why they're not stepping up publicly. We expect folks to be in Congress. You know, our founders, the framers of the Constitution, believe that the Congress would be a check on the executive, and that's just not happening. And, you know, I suppose it may not happen until they believe that supporting President Trump is detrimental to their political future. And hopefully that will become apparent in the elections in 2018.
Senator Gary Peters, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Great to be with you, as always.
Tomorrow, right here on Stateside, active shooter drills in our schools. We'll hear from the teachers who are running those drills.
You know, it's not unlike any caregiver role in any situation where you try and help keep people calm and you help distract people from the potential danger and the reality of what they may be facing.
The kids are watching some of these things, so they may not make the connection while they're doing the drill, but in the back of their mind, they have seen that horror. Also, a well-planned drill during a practice, you know, goes really well, but then in the middle of a crisis, the first thing the kids do is call mom and dad. And when they're calling their parents, then there's all these phone calls and cars in the parking lot, and so it's not as clean as we think. So I think the kids are affected because I think they're seeing their peers. They're talking about it online, unlike us. We just kind of let it go, and it was not a big deal.
That story and much more tomorrow right here on Stateside.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.